Good morning. Here comes the cable news for Monday, January 30th. I'm Blaine Palmer.
And I'm Becca Barlson. The Senate will hold a trial today on the confirmation of Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court.
In Houston, jury selection begins in the trial of former Enron executives Jeffrey Skilling and Ken Lay.
And in London, Condoleezza Rice is saying that aid to Palestine will be cut off until Hamas renounces suicide attacks against Israel, Israeli settlers occupying Palestinian land.
Gung Hei Fat Choi, the beginning of the Lunar New Year. And it's also Dick Cheney's birthday, if you want to send him something. Portland area weather today, a flood watch is still in effect for parts of northwestern Oregon. Portland today, showers, isolated thunderstorms in the morning, highs around 50. Tonight will be mostly cloudy with a chance of showers, lows around 40. Mayor Tom Potter called for change at the Portland Development Commission when he ran for office in 2004. Potter wanted the commission to focus more on small and minority-owned businesses in troubled parts of town. A year into his first term, Potter's campaign promise is taking shape. The commission this week agreed to set aside $750,000 for small business working capital loans. It's the third program the commission created for companies with 50 or fewer to meet Potter's request. The Urban Renewal Agency and the Portland Family of Funds will raise the money by selling federal new markets tax credits designed to spur reinvestments in troubled parts of town. Ethan Dunham, chairman of the city's Small Business Advisory Council, says the small business loans are the right way to boost the economy in struggling parts of the city. The program is unusual for the Development Commission because it comes with fewer restrictions than most of its spending. The new loan fund can be spent in any part of Portland that qualifies as low income. Bob Alexander, Economic Development Director, says we're trying to get creative on ways to assist businesses outside of urban renewal areas. This from the Oregonian.
A class action lawsuit has been filed to shield 21,000 retired Oregon public employees from having to reimburse the state pension fund for past overpayments into their pension accounts. The suit filed in Multnomah Circuit Court challenges Friday's decision by the Public Employees Retirement System Board to recoup the money from the retirees. At stake is hundreds of millions of dollars granted to so-called window retirees, those who left public service between April 1, 2000 and March 31, 2004. Pairs agreed to recover money from those retirees after Marion Circuit Court Judge Paul Lipscomb ruled that pairs put excessive amounts into worker pension accounts from the pensions fund's 1999 investment earnings. Public employees will repay the money via reductions in their pensions accounts. Retirees under Friday's PAIRS decision will pay the money back through reductions in their monthly checks during the rest of their lives. That has been dubbed a kinder and gentler approach because PAIRS hopes it can get the money back without serious cuts in most pensioners' checks. Most of the reductions will be delayed until they can be offset by annual cost of living increases of 2%. Retirees still contest the notion that there were overpayments or that they should pay them back. Retirees have planned a legal challenge since the Oregon Supreme Court upheld the Lipscomb ruling in August. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
Last Friday, the Portland Peaceful Response Coalition held its weekly downtown gathering. This time, the coalition sent a message to Senator Hillary Clinton, who was in Portland this weekend for a fundraiser. The message, bring our troops home now. KBOO's Andy Seaton was at the Pioneer Courthouse Square and has this report.
It's a beautiful late winter, early global warming spring day. The flowers are beginning to sprout down here. We've got a good turnout down at the Portland Peaceful Response Coalition March, regular Friday March. They've been doing this for over 4 years since the invasion of Afghanistan. And there's a special guest in town tonight, Hillary Clinton. And a longtime volunteer, Will Seaman, is here to talk about it.
Will, are you there?
I'm there, yes. There, along with several other groups, Code Pink, for example, Veterans for Peace, Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights, PPRC is going to be a part of a local greeting for Senator Hillary Clinton, who's in town to do, of all things, fundraising. And, of course, I think KBOO listeners know, but certainly the peace movement knows, that Hillary Clinton, like John Kerry before her, upon deciding to aim for the White House, has been sprinting to the right. And we are out here, we're certainly going to be out in front of the Executive Hilton when she gets here, to say that the trend is in the other direction. The trend is against this war and occupation, and we're going to try to remind her to embrace once again some policies that have been traditional policies of the Democratic Party, and we'd like them to once again be a part of that party's platform.
She's coming to the downtown Clinton, or rather to the downtown Hilton there. When will she be coming in?
It's the executive Hilton. We're going to be gathering out there probably sometime between 7 and 7:30. The festivities, which are going to involve also the rest of the Oregon Democratic delegation, Blumenauer, Cooley, DeFazio, Wu, all of them will be there. And that's at the executive Hilton, and I think it's 921 Southwest 6th here in downtown Portland.
Uh-huh. And why are you targeting Hillary especially?
Well, we're targeting her as a something of an opportunity, but also we're quite appalled by the fact that this standard bearer for the Democratic Party, this person who is sort of the presumed candidate for the presidency in 2008, has been moving in the conservative direction, just like John Kerry before her in his disastrous run for the president. She has not taken a strong stand against this war, whereas that is precisely the direction of most of this country. She has taken an appalling stand on, for example, the apartheid wall in Israel and the occupied territories. She has come out in support of a wall that the International Court in the Hague found to be a breach of international law. These kind of policies are not what is going to get a Democrat into the White House. But more importantly, these kind of policies are just plain wrong. They're wrong principally, they're wrong ethically. We have to oppose them.
All right. Thank you very much, Will Seaman.
Thank you.
Down at the Portland, with the Portland Peaceful Response Coalition down at Pioneer Courthouse Square. And that was Andy Seaton with KBOO News.
The presence of mountain lions or cougars in Oregon is a controversial issue. In the first of a two-part series, KBOO's Aaron Ernst looks at a success story involving a cougar and human interaction.
That's the sound of Felis domestica, more commonly known as the house cat, whose small size in relationship with humans has allowed it to thrive. Its close relative, the mountain lion or cougar, has been less fortunate. Its numbers have only recently started to recover in Oregon after being hunted close to extinction in the 1960s. Ironically, its perceived recovery may now be its greatest threat. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is putting the final touches on a draft mountain lion culling plan that calls for the killing of over 2,000 cougars throughout the state.
Shooting lions at random, whether or not they've caused a problem, does not do anything to increase safety of either yourself or your pets or your livestock.
Lynn Sadler is CEO and president of the Mountain Lion Foundation, a 20-year-old national nonprofit dedicated to saving America's lions.
Anytime that you shoot a male mountain lion, you create a space for a younger lion that may not have been ready to disperse. And that lion may not be as successful taking its normal prey of deer and elk. And if it's not, it's going to look for easier prey, and frequently that could be livestock.
The foundation feels that the current draft plan favors a small but vocal minority of people with exaggerated fears about the true dangers posed by cougars.
It's very important that the citizens of Oregon be involved in this plan, because right now it appears that the plan is being guided by the interests of a few groups that are concerned about mountain lions, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Oregonians who are concerned about mountain lion conservation.
Christopher Papuchis is a conservation biologist for the foundation.
The commission will be meeting again on February 9th. They will be taking public comment on the plan. Folks can go onto the Fish and Wildlife Commission website to identify where they can send comments and where they can go to give comments in public.
Reporting for KBOO, this is Aaron Ernst.
NASA's senior climate scientist accused the Bush administration yesterday of trying to stop him speaking out about global warming. This according to The Telegraph. James Hansen said NASA officials ordered his lectures, papers, and website postings to be reviewed before publication. He called last month for an immediate reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. Requests for interviews were also being screened. He said he'd been told there would be dire consequences if he repeated his warnings about climate change. His accusation goes to the heart of the claim of opponents of President Bush that his administration is one of the more secretive in recent history. Veteran Washington reporters claim that it is harder to speak to officials in this administration than any other in living memory. The White House is also accused of politicizing science. Hansen's calls for significant mandatory cuts in greenhouse emissions run directly counter to the policy of the administration, which disputes the science linking emissions to climate change. Dean Acosta, NASA's deputy head of public affairs, denied there was an attempt to muzzle Hansen. But Hansen, the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, said the public had been sheltered from findings about the potential risks of climate change. He said communicating with the public seems to be essential because public concern is probably the only thing capable of overcoming the special interests that have obfuscated the topic.
The judge trying former Enron bosses Ken Lay and Jeffrey Skilling for their alleged role in the firm's collapse will seek to select a jury today. This from the BBC. More than 100 potential jurors are due to appear in a court in Houston, Texas, in a prelude to the start of the long-awaited criminal trial. U.S. District Judge Sim Lake has said he will question potential jurors himself to determine their suitability. The trial, which could start as early as tomorrow, may last up to 4 months. Former Enron chairman Ken Lay faces 7 counts of fraud and conspiracy relating to the firm's collapse in 2001, which followed a huge accounting scandal. Skilling faces 31 counts of fraud, conspiracy, insider trading, and lying to auditors about Enron's financial position. The problem with high-profile trials is that you have jurors wanting to be on because it is their moment to interface with fame. The key task of selecting a 16-person jury, 12 jurors, and 4 alternates, aroused controversy long before it got underway. Lawyers for the defendants have called for the trial to be moved away from Houston. They are arguing that holding it in Enron's home city means their clients will not be able to get a fair hearing.
Senator Barack Obama says he will vote today to filibuster Judge Samuel Alito's confirmation to the Supreme Court, but he conceded the effort may be futile. Obama criticized Democrats for failing to persuade Americans to take notice of the court's changing ideological face. Despite his criticism, Obama announced his intention to support the maneuver designed to block or delay Alito's confirmation this week. The movement, which was launched by Senator John Kerry, appeared to lack the 41 senators needed to be successful. Alito, a federal appeals court judge, is poised to succeed retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. The Senate is scheduled to cast a final vote on Alito's confirmation tomorrow. The threat of a filibuster emerged late last week after liberal activists accused Democratic senators of failing to vigorously oppose Alito's ascension to the Supreme Court. After Kerry began the effort, several liberal groups mounted a campaign by internet, telephone, and fax to persuade other senators to follow suit.
Liberal groups are capitalizing on the F-word, filibuster. They're coming out in unison and urging Democrats to follow Senator John Kerry's lead and block the confirmation of Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito. But as FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports from Capitol Hill, some Democrats won't go down that road. Sorry, we're having technical difficulties.
Immediately after Hurricane Katrina hit, hundreds of available trucks, boats, planes, and federal officers were unused in search and rescue efforts because FEMA failed to give them missions. New documents show that the Federal Emergency Management Agency called off its search and rescue operations in Louisiana 3 days after the storm because of security issues. According to internal FEMA email given to Senate investigators, the documents are further evidence of lapses in FEMA's response to Katrina. They also detail breakdowns in carrying out the National Response Plan, which was issued a year ago specifically to coordinate response efforts during disasters. A spokesman for the Homeland Security Department, which includes FEMA, did not dispute the documents. Responding to a questionnaire posed by investigators, Interior Department Assistant Secretary P. Lynn Scarlett said her agency offered to supply FEMA with 300 dump trucks and other vehicles, 300 boats, 11 aircraft, and 400 law enforcement officers to help search and rescue efforts. Scarlett said the FEMA did not avail itself of the offers. Other Interior Department resources that were offered but unused included flat-bottom boats for shallow water rescues. Clearly, these assets and skills were precisely relevant in the post-Katrina environment.
A U.S. court-martial in Afghanistan has found an American soldier guilty of mistreating two prisoners at a military base in Uruzgan province. James Hayes was found guilty of one count of conspiracy to maltreat and two counts of maltreatment, according to the BBC. His punishment includes 4 months in prison in Kuwait. Another soldier faces a court-martial over the same incident, which took place last July. His trial is due to start on today. The U.S. military says the detainees do not require medical attention. Human rights groups have often accused U.S. forces of abusing Afghans held at U.S. detention centers in the country. Specialist Hayes was accused of punching detainees in the chest, arms, and shoulders. The U.S. military said his punishment would comprise reduction in rank to private, total forfeiture of all pay and allowances for 4 months, and confinement for 4 months. The charges against the soldiers came in October, close on the heels of accusations that U.S. forces burned the bodies of Taliban fighters, an act considered sacrilege in Islam. At least 8 prisoners have died in U.S. custody since 2001.
A Republican member of the Senate Intelligence Committee says that President Bush has more explaining to do on his domestic spy program. Republican Senator Chuck Hagel cast doubts on the administration's assertion of broad executive power. Hagel said he's looking forward to congressional hearings on the legal justification for the secretive National Security Agency program. He remains unconvinced that Bush could allow the program without fully consulting with the courts or Congress. The Senate Judiciary Committee holds hearings beginning February 6th. The Senate Intelligence Committee will hold similar closed-door sessions on the matter. Yesterday, Bush's spokesman Dan Bartlett said Bush has ample constitutional authority as commander-in-chief and under a 2001 congressional resolution authorizing force in the war against terror. He said additional briefings and debate with Congress could risk security by tipping off the enemy. Hagel and Democratic Senator Barack Obama said they remain open to hearing testimony from Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and other administration officials, but they were uncertain that a president could have broad blank check authority.
According to the Washington Post, a co-anchor of ABC's World News Tonight and ABC cameraman suffered serious head wounds yesterday in a roadside bomb attack in Tahi. They were stabilized at a military hospital and were expected to be flown to Germany for further medical care, the network said in a statement. Bob Woodruff, who took over the anchor duties for the weeknight broadcast earlier this month, and cameraman Doug Bott were embedded with the U.S. Army's 4th Infantry Division. They were traveling with an Iraqi unit in an Iraqi vehicle when the explosion occurred. An Iraqi soldier was also wounded in the attack. ABC News said on its website that both Woodruff and Vogt were partially exposed because they were standing in the vehicle's hatch. They both suffered head injuries, and Woodruff also suffered wounds to his upper body, the network said. They were flown to Baghdad's fortified Green Zone and then to a hospital on a U.S. base in Balad, northwest of the capital, where both underwent lengthy surgeries that stabilized their conditions.
Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist said yesterday he still sees the necessity of war in Iraq, despite the lack of weapons of mass destruction, but probably would have placed more U.S. troops there. President Bush long has maintained that commanders on the ground have determined troop levels. Critics of the administration's conduct of the war maintain that far too few soldiers were deployed after the U.S. decided to invade Iraq in March 2003. A recent study for the Pentagon said the Army has been overextended by wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and may not be able to retain and recruit enough troops to defeat the insurgency in Iraq. Bush and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld discounted the study's assertion and said U.S. forces were capable of completing their mission.
House Republicans will choose a leader to replace Tom DeLay this week in a private election that holds major significance for their party's public image as they held uneasily toward crucial midterm elections. 3 lawmakers, Roy Blunt of Missouri, John A. Bonner of Ohio, and John Shadegg of Arizona, are running for the majority leader post being vacated by Representative DeLay, the polarizing Texan who is credited with much of the party's congressional success, but who was pushed from leadership in part because of his ties to the lobbyist Jack Abramoff. All 3 men are supporting various initiatives intended to limit the influence of lobbyists and promising other changes in the way the House does business. But the veteran lawmakers, particularly Blunt and Bonner, have faced questions about their own close connections to the capitalist lobbying and fundraising community. The 3 men are little known to the public at large, but the winner of Thursday's secret ballot will become the new face for House Republicans. With Speaker Dennis Hastert, the winner will be responsible for shaping the party's policies and strategies in a year that could pose the most serious threat to Republican control of the House since the Democratic majority was ousted in 1994. It will be the first time since the takeover that delay will be out of the leadership. Watchdog groups, Democrats, and some Republicans have taken aim at Blunt and Bonner. They are asserting that they have built the type of networks coming from increasing scrutiny, with former aides who have become lobbyists seeking to persuade the lawmakers on policy matters while providing political and fundraising support. Both men dismiss any suggestion of impropriety. This from the New York Times.
Election boards around the country are trying to sell, recycle, or dispose of countless voting machines, rendered obsolete by a new federal law requiring upgrades. Keith Cunningham is director of the Allen County Elections Board in Northwest Ohio. He says right now there's no secondary market for the used equipment. Cunningham has toyed with the idea of leasing the machines for elections involving unions or community groups. He jokes that the best scenario might be a third world country that needs a quick infusion of voting machines. In fact, a county clerk in Muncie, Indiana, has discussed the possibility of sending old voting machines to an African country, but her office says nothing has been finalized.
A senior Hamas leader has appealed to the European Union not to halt the funding of the Palestinian Authority following the militant group's election victory. Ismail Haniya spoke as EU foreign ministers were meeting in Brussels to discuss the halting aid. Haniya called for unconditional talks between Hamas and international donors, saying no aid money would be used to fund attacks on Israel. EU member states donated about $600 million to the Palestinians in 2005. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said it would be unthinkable for the EU to keep funding the PA unless Hamas renounced violence against Israel. The US, EU, UN, and Russia, co-sponsors of the stalled Roadmap Peace Plan, are meeting in London on Monday evening. This meeting of the so-called quartet will be looking at the prospects for peace in the Middle East in the light of Hamas's surprise victory. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, in London for the meeting, has said the U.S. will fulfill its current aid commitments to Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas, but will not give money to a Hamas government.
Officials say Iraq has its first known death from the deadly strain of bird flu. A U.N. official and the region's health minister say the victim is a 15-year-old girl who died earlier this month in a Kurdish area of northern Iraq near Turkey, which is battling an outbreak of the virus. The U.S. Navy Medical Research Unit in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, conducted the tests to determine the cause of death. The U.N. official, who refused to be named because of the sensitivity of the issue, supervised the examination of samples sent by the government in northern Iraq. He says 30 other samples from the region are being tested. This KABU program has been made possible in part by a KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, now offering Los Toraja, a rare Indonesian coffee produced by 100-year-old heirloom trees, nutty and mildly sweet, for a limited time at Pete's retail stores or on the web at Pete's.com.
This KABU program has been made possible also in part of KABU Foundation members and a grant from Awaken Media presenting The Real Dirt on Farmer John, a film about the true story of maverick farmer John Peterson's hero's journey of life, love, death, and sweet potatoes. Opens Wednesday, February 1st at Cinema 21. Information at therealdirt.net. The trial of Saddam Hussein and seven co-defendants for crimes against humanity was in disarray after a courtroom session in which Saddam's half-brother was dragged away by guards, the defense team walked out, and the former Iraqi dictator was ejected following a slanging match with the new chief judge, this according to The Guardian. Once order was restored, the only half of the defendants and none of the defense team present. the court inside Baghdad's Green Zone heard evidence from three witnesses about an alleged massacre of about 140 people by Ba'ath Party loyalists in Dujail in 1982 after an assassination attempt on Saddam. But their often harrowing testimonies were all but drowned out by the high drama of the morning. Yesterday was only the eighth session since the trial began on October 19th. Many Iraqis fear the trial will prove a national embarrassment. Amid violence and political division, defense lawyers and other critics also doubt whether a fair trial of the former Ba'athist regime leaders, seen by some as vital to the process of national reconciliation, is possible. The former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who is part of Saddam's defense team, last night described the court as lawless. Another defense lawyer promised a boycott of the next session of the trial unless the chief judge apologized for expelling defendants and lawyers. But the Iraqi chief prosecutor said the trial was still on track and that discipline had now been established. At the start of yesterday's session, the new presiding judge made clear his no-nonsense approach. He said political speeches were forbidden, adding, "If any defendant crosses the lines, he will be taken out of the room and his trial will be carried out with his absence." The trial was adjourned until later in the week.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has threatened to resign unless Hamas agrees to a government and policies that can win international recognition and continued foreign aid. According to The Guardian, Abbas has drafted a resignation letter and warned he will submit it if talks with Hamas do not produce an administration that can work with foreign governments. Two sides have reached broad agreement on the shape of an administration, with Hamas taking cabinet posts relevant to its domestic reform agenda and other parties controlling positions such as foreign affairs and security. But there remain obstacles over the future of Hamas's armed wing and its insistence that it will not recognize Israel, which are major blocks to foreign cooperation and negotiations. Condoleezza Rice called Abbas after the Hamas victory last week and asked him not to resign. But his future may in part be decided by what Ms. Rice and Russian, European, and UN officials decide in London today. They are meeting to discuss a response to the Hamas victory. The U.S. and the EU, the largest contributors of aid to the Palestinians, have warned that they may withhold funds. Hamas wants to integrate its fighters into the PA forces, the Palestinian Authority forces, and to see them remodeled as a Palestinian army. But it is not demanding direct control, in part so that it can assuage foreign concerns by saying it has rid itself of its militia.
The Nobel Prize-winning playwright Dario Fo was greeted with cheers yesterday as he cast his vote in the first round of his bid to become mayor of Milan. The 79-year-old satirist arrived with his actor wife, Franco Reim, to cast his vote at one of the 124 polling stations open across the city. The center-left candidate said he was hopeful of winning the primary against three other candidates. The man, known for his scathing attacks on the rich and powerful, has run a controversial and colorful campaign. Fo has pledged to rid Milan of the money-grabbing bastards who have run the city for decades. London's mayor, Ken Livingstone, who visited Milan last week, is one of his supporters. With three other candidates up for election yesterday, the real race was acknowledged to be between Fo and his nearest rival, Bruno Ferrante, the former chief of police in Milan. The EU is set to hold last-minute talks with Iran, at Tehran's request, to try to resolve a standoff over Iran's controversial nuclear program. Iran requested the meeting with envoys from Britain, France, and Germany. Foreign ministers from the EU3 will also discuss the issue at separate talks in London with their counterparts from U.S., Russia, and China. The EU and U.S. want Iran to be referred to the Council for possible sanctions after Tehran restarted its nuclear program. They suspect that Iran is aiming to produce nuclear weapons. Tehran says its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes only. Washington, many European powers, and also Israel distrust Iran, partly because it has kept its nuclear research secret for 18 years before it was revealed in 2002. A British spokesman said the three European nations would listen to what Tehran had to say in Brussels, according to the BBC. But the spokesman said Europe's position remained unchanged. It was time for the UN Security Council to become involved. Moscow and Beijing have argued for Iran to be given more time, but neither has completely ruled out having the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, refer Iran to the UN Security Council, which can impose sanctions. Iranian officials have previously said they have nothing to fear from such a move and that sanctions would hurt the West more than Iran.
Italian Premier Silvio Berlusconi has promised Italians he would lower taxes and raise pensions. Berlusconi's challenger in the vote is Romano Prodi, a center-left leader and former premier, and Il Giornale, a conservative Milan daily, owned by Paolo Berlusconi, the premier's brother, is reporting Berlusconi's latest campaign pledge. It's a rather personal one. No sex until after April 9th elections. A clergyman has praised the premier for what he described as a defense of family values and promised that his followers would support the conservative leader because if the left wins, it will be the moral end for this country. We have no word at this time on the response from Mrs. Berlusconi.
An estimated 100,000 people have attended the funeral of one of Latin America's best-known revolutionary leaders, Shafiq Handal. Handal, a former top commander of El Salvador's left-wing FMLN guerrillas, died on Tuesday of a heart attack. Delegations come from across Latin America for the funeral. The crowd, perhaps the largest gathering in El Salvador in 25 years, chanted revolutionary slogans as they followed Handal's coffin. The red shirts of the former guerrillas filled San Salvador's central square where the funeral mass was held, as well as the surrounding streets. Shafiq Handal was the main leader of the political party formed by El Salvador's left-wing guerrillas at the end of civil war in 1992. During the war, he was a top guerrilla top commander for 12 years, defying the largest U.S.-led counterinsurgency efforts since Vietnam. Before that, he was a veteran of decades of clandestine struggle against one of Latin America's most brutal military dictatorships, suffering imprisonment and exile. San Salvador's deputy archbishop, Monsignor Rosa Chavez, said Handel had himself wanted to be remembered as a fighter for democracy in his country, who struggled to get the people of El Salvador the right to choose for themselves. His death will leave a gap in the leadership of the former guerrillas and the main opposition party as they start campaigning for midterm elections due to be held in March.
This has been the KBOO Morning News for Monday, January 30th. Chris Andre edited the news. KBOO volunteers edited the tape stories. Jim Thompson's on the board right now. KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Blaine Palmer.
And I'm Becca Bartleson. Portland area weather today. A flood watch is still in effect for parts of northwestern Oregon. In Portland today, showers, isolated thunderstorms in the morning. Highs around 50. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers, lows around 40.
KBOO clears the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us this evening at 5 for the KBOO Evening News.
Wondering what to do with that news on your mind? Volunteer in the KBOO Morning News. Call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202 to find out how you can get involved. And visit our website at www.kboo.fm.
Coming up on KBOO this morning at 7:30, Cecil and Celeste host More Talk Radio. Their guest is Christian Weller, senior economist at the Center for American Progress, and the topic is pensions for U.S. workers. What's the future? At 9 on the Old Mole Variety Hour, issues include Israel-Palestine and the Hamas victory.
At 10, Dr. David Naiman hosts Health Watch. He'll have an interview with naturopathic physicians Dr. Kimberly Winstar and Dr. Steven Sandberg Lewis on natural approaches to cardiovascular health. At 10:30 on Earth Watch, Chris Andre hosts, and at 11 it's Democracy Now. Have a lovely day.
Thanks for listening.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Awakened Media, presenting The Real Dirt on Farmer John, a film about the true story of maverick farmer John Peterson's hero's journey of life, love, death, and sweet potatoes. Opens Wednesday, February 1st at Cinema 21. Information at therealdirt.net. This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.